Welcome everybody for joining. Joe, thank you for being here with us. Today we're going to talk about a topic that you know a lot about, Joe, and the topic is how to balance efficiency, productivity, and quality excellence in today's organizations. Interesting topic, as we'll see. I want to do a quick intro of you, Joe, just so everybody knows a bit about your background. You're a former CEO of Duran Institute and currently managing principal of Attain Partners. You have more than 30 years of experience in this field. You're, one of the old salts, I could say, in the industry. Lots and lots of experience in all different areas and all different levels. We look forward to benefiting from that, from your experience in this conversation. And thanks again for joining. The webinar will last between 45 minutes and an hour. It is being recorded, so please be aware. And we are going to share the recording with all of the attendees afterwards. If we'd love it to keep this interactive and informal, Joe's absolutely ready, willing, and able to answer all sorts of questions. So if you want to ask a question, do so. Put it in the chat facility that you just used to share your location, and we'll try and fold that into the conversation. If not, we'll have a separate Q&A at the end to make sure that every question is addressed. All right, so Joe, let's kick this off. You recently wrote a paper that I had the pleasure of reading that provides sort of a theory or a thesis on what may lie behind the manufacturing trend recently, the rise in quality failures, like the ones we've seen in recent years at Boeing, Tesla, Volkswagen, Samsung. So maybe to get us all on the same page, could you just summarize in your own words, what you think, what this trend is that you're looking at, what's causing it, kick us off that way?
Yeah, sure. And thank you, Niels, for inviting me to this webinar. And yesterday on Wall Street was one of the worst days of the year, precipitated by Ford's announcement that they exceeded revenues, but their bottom line was trashed because of excessive warranties due to quality problems. Hmm. So just add another major brand,
right,
to the list of brands that I talked about with you earlier. So, and I know a couple of people online here that are on this call will probably chime in. When the Boeing crisis hit in the last few months, broader than it did when the crash a few years ago, my concern was not so much for Boeing. You know, companies will figure it out, but smaller companies and supply chains that live off of Boeing would suffer because they're part of that supply chain, or they look up to them as a, you know, as a hero in the industry, particularly for quality. And the other concern is people do what the bigger companies do. So years ago, when the Malcolm Baldrige Award became in vogue in the United States to help us improve competitiveness, the whole concept was sharing of what we do to get good, what we do to stay good. And my concern is that the Boeings, who are not so good like they were, are sharing their knowledge. But then as I looked into it, I started to look at commonalities between all these companies. I started to challenge, and I started to see it in my own audit process. But, you know, here you have major brand companies, major critical brands to countries. So Samsung to, you know, Korea, and Toyota to Japan, and Boeing to US, and Tesla and others. And I see even in Europe now, you know, a number of major brands having trouble. Now, over the time, everybody has quality problems, but to the magnitude of these problems, big. And what it, my theory was, maybe it's not leadership, maybe it's complacency because they think their quality system is good. Hmm. And so one thing about all these companies, they're all registered to a third party audit system, whether it's an AS9100 in aerospace or, you know, automotive or ISO 9000, they all have a third party registration. They're all third party audited. And more than likely, all of those companies have internal audits. And so here you have a quality system that is passing the grade and getting third-party registration, but I'll use Ford as an example. If Ford had excessive warranties and they still passed their quality management system, it then has to question the quality management system and the audit practice. And the reality is all of the quality management systems audits, internal and external, are qualitative. Mm. Here are the things we're supposed to be doing. Here are the things we do. Mm. Well, therein lies probably the failure, is that what if the audit was quantitative, meaning we started with, show me your metrics on how you're performing to your targets. And so show me your defect rates in production. Show me whether it's in percent, part per million, whatever. Show me that. Show me your target. You're not meeting your target, major nonconformance.
Right.
Instead of no minor or major nonconformance, there's nothing, because that's not part of the audit. So my feeling was that people are complacent because they think they're good enough to pass an audit, then they're good enough to pass product quality, when in fact it's two different things. And this right. this was our complaint from day one. When anybody goes to a third party audit, I'm not trashing the auditing process. I'm trashing the fact that it's qualitative in nature, not quantitative.
Right.
So the organizations where we spend time actually looking at what's their performance, current state, you can say, okay, well, why are you still at that level? And it's not an acceptable level of quality. So why are you at 100,000 parts per million when your target is 10? You know, why? And when you start answering those questions, you start getting excitement. You start getting people saying, well, we don't know how to do this, we don't know how to do that. Well, you have a quality system. Yeah, but. So bottom line is I believe that if you want to exceed beyond, you know, just meeting customer requirements and making the company profitable through to less defect, less deficiency, less failure, you got to really address your quality management system and try to make it more quantifiable.
That's the
basis of it. It's coming out in Quality Magazine in August.
Great. So we'll look forward to that. And super interesting thesis. So let's explore root causes before we go into, you know, dive it more into solutions, Joe. So what do you think, what's your theory on what's causing that shift in sort of the, you know, moving away from in focus from quality and focusing more on operational efficiency and productivity?
I have to be careful that I don't go too far from what a Dr. Duran might say, but it was planned that way. It was planned that way. In the 1980s, we had generally a quality crisis, meaning businesses were suffering because product quality was not up to par with Japanese quality, and in particular. And as a result, we had to catch up. And a lot of us, some were in quality, some were not in quality, but it was in quality, meaning the quality of the product. So a lot of us got a lot of training and education on how to improve product quality. And those methods evolved from the 80s and the 90s. And we did a lot of sharing. And you know, by the late 1990s, we were really back on top. And what changed was the drive to focus on improving product quality. As things got better, organizations then started to say, how could I improve profitability, productivity, efficiency? And those same methods and tools started now getting aimed at, let's reduce cost, and at the expense of other things like quality. So for instance, there have been a decline in the quality management function over the last 30 years in terms of how many people are doing quality. Some of it good, some of it bad. I mean, the good part is that we probably, you know, you eliminate inspection because you get better at product process control. So you don't have to inspect so much. So there's less people. But what started to happen is you started to remove the education, you remove the experience, remove the knowledge of how to manage for quality, and replace it with organizational wide improvement systems. So, but the difference is those Lean and Six Sigma methods were aimed at something different than product quality. They were aimed at reducing cost, improving productivity. And when you do that in the absence of that real important feature of quality, you get, you know, less and less capable at making good product quality but you are more profitable because it looks like, you know, you've saved money. So the shift, one of my root causes, the shift from the purpose of the method aimed at product quality versus the purpose of the method aimed at improving cost or reducing cost. That's one. This, and what that has led to is, and you notice this proliferation of a lot of Lean Six Sigma belts, which is great. Even Dr. Duran, before he passed, said one of the best things about Lean Six Sigma was the certification of belts. The problem is those belts aren't allowed to work on product quality per se in the organizations that believe that they can reduce costs. And you know, you can reduce costs with quality because quality, cost of poor quality is a cost. But these are, what I like to think about it is that a product in the face of the customer has got two aspects. One is the features they buy, and one is the level of defect they buy, level of performance. Duran called that the feature quality and the deficiency. And the quality tools were aimed at eliminating a lot of that deficiency. And it stopped somewhere along the line in the last decade when the shift in this whole process went from, you know, the thinking of product quality to efficiency, is that we got good enough and companies weren't really doing a great job of root cause analysis. And instead of taking out improving deficiencies, we started to remove features. You know, people started to take out bodies that did process capability studies, bodies that did really good root cause analysis. And so what you end up with is a weak system. And the weak system is going to have a rare critical failure at some point.
And do you think that, so the shift from quality to productivity or efficiency, you used the word complacency earlier. Do you think, you know, it could be a choice, right? Under the assumption that the quality system will, you know, is strong and therefore I can make this, you know, sort of leadership decision to focus more on operational efficiency and will be, you know, the quality will still be good. Or do you think leaders are knowingly accepting more risk when they take these decisions? So are they misinformed? Are they, you know, what's going on underneath that decision? Or is it not even an active decision? Is it something that just organically happened?
I think the latter is, they're not misinformed, they're uninformed. Meaning, because I'm not seeing any red flags, because I'm not seeing any major non-conformances, I'm going to say that's okay.
Right.
And so here's what leadership has to be trained in is what to ask for of the quality management system. Okay. One is they believe that the audit process is good, the external third-party process, but it's flawed. And you can see Gary's comments there. I'll use Gary's word, flawed. It's flawed because you pay the third-party auditor to audit you.
Right.
Well, if I want to get paid the third time around and the fourth time around, okay. But the question should be, how many major non-conformances have we had in the last 3 years? I'll bet it's none. And if it's none and I'm looking at my scorecard, how can that be? Right. So the system of how I determine what's major and minor, you're conforming to your quality system, but I have no data to say how the quality system is performing. Mm-hmm. So the internal, you have a lot of layered process audits in companies today, and internal audits, they're the ones that should be quantitative. They should be asking those questions.
Right.
And giving yourself major nonconformances. So leadership is uninformed because they don't see they don't see a red flag, so they're not going to act on it. The only red flag they act on is when there's a failure, and it's usually too late. Mm-hmm. My theory, I think I have others. So you got to overly confident that I have a quality system that is registered to a third party, mm-hmm. an audit by a third party that says it's good, and an internal audit that says it's good. Why should I bother worrying about it?
Right. Fair point.
And yet at the same time, there's been a lot of theories that's, you know, blame the operators, blame the manufacturing managers, blame leadership for complacency. I just think they're complacent because they don't see any real correlation of failure.
Right. Typically, leaders are rational actors, right? If they know that, you know, structural quality issues in the end is not going to, you know, lead to profitable growth. So they you know, they're not incentivized to not focus on quality.
Yeah. My biggest criticism of leadership in large companies is that the selection of the highest level quality professional did not necessarily grow up through the manufacturing, production, quality, understand measurement track. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't have that deep understanding of cause and effect in production, it's very hard to manage quality in the absence of that. Interesting. In fact, not having management disciplines.
Interesting. We have an interesting question from Marcia. I want to see if you can talk to that. The question is, the emphasis on quality cost seems to have disappeared. Why is that? If we're talking about root cause, should that also include cost impacts?
If you were to Google cost of poor quality, you'll probably see a lot of references come up under Duran, because the last 30 years we did a lot of research. And it has been downplayed for a number of reasons, good and bad. So the cost of quality was initially a means to say to leadership, here's the potential impact of not doing things well. And you could estimate it with real calculations from real numbers, rework, redos, excess inspection, all these things, and you can quantify it. And that quantification became a means to drive improvement. My belief is that the companies got so big, some of these companies got so large, that even the level of the worst place in cost of poor quality wasn't enough to get them excited. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. I was in a pharmaceutical company. I said, you got about $100 million in cost of poor quality and that you should get rid of it. And he said, well, that's great, but our next two new drugs are going to generate about $5 billion. And we don't really care about $100 million. So there's one of those things. But I think the cost of poor quality and the cost of quality has been misused by the people who use them themselves. It has not been an estimate. It has not been thoroughly looked at as a cost of poor quality. So a lot of the cost of quality accounting systems in companies show small cost of poor quality. They only account for manufacturing quality. They don't look at other types of poor quality outside of manufacturing. So with the numbers low, people don't get excited. Same thing, the alarms don't go off. Mm-hmm. And the third one is people want to try to account for every dime of cost of poor quality. And that's not its purpose. So the accountants get involved and leadership gets involved, and then they don't see it change. And that's the real problem, is that cost of poor quality will not change unless you aim something at the change. So if we have high rework, then we should have projects aimed at reducing rework. If we have high customer complaints. So the belief is that the number is going to change on its own. It doesn't. So you got these three factors all working against it. I truly believe the benefit is there. With my clients, we try to make them understand the benefit of it. But in fact, a lot of these companies are so big that they don't necessarily see the value in that so much until a crisis hits. Now so the cost of poor quality at Boeing, the cost of poor quality at, you know, yesterday at Ford, 11% drop in share price. That's a major hit, on shareholder value. So,
yeah, Gary makes an interesting point that, he's not quite willing to let leadership off the hook, is my read. He's saying they're uninformed because they don't look right. So it's one thing to say, you know, they're not getting the right signals from the audits. But I guess it's a fair point, too. Right. There's a, you know, we shouldn't assume, no leader should assume that everything is operating, you know, perfectly. There's a responsibility to poke and prod and go look, see what's going on yourself. So what's your take on that?
I agree with him 100%. With so much emphasis on risk management these days, you would expect someone at the highest level to walk around and see what's happening. The problem is when your headquarters is in Washington and your manufacturing's all over the world, you've got to do a really long demo walk. It's not a, you know, walk out on the factory floor. We used to be able to walk out on the factory floor every day. So you could see things, you could talk to people. Right. So one is they're pulled apart from that floor. But you could do a gemba walk in other ways. And I think that's what Gary's getting at, is that ask the right questions and not avoid the answer. So, you know, this whole concept of, wow, we've had no nonconformances for 3 years and I'm seeing a lot of complaints. How is that possible? So a gemba walk could be in the questions you ask, not just in the physical movement of someone. Because a lot of times you don't see the failure on a shop floor because it's marginal, meaning, you know, you're not, it's not like you're seeing defects shoot out the box. So you have to know what to ask for. And not only that, I'll tell you one thing. I've done so many gemba walks in organizations that have whiteboards and visual management boards that are not up to date. They're not accurate. So even if you walk around, you've got to know what question to ask. And I think maybe we give leadership 3 or 4 questions. And you kind of think, you know, there's huge leadership in these big, big organizations.
Right.
Which is why small organizations don't have the same kind of problems, because you can walk every day. You do talk to people. You wear multiple hats. And so you're able to see and look and do what you need to.
Fair point. So a question that was asked before the webinar was sent in advance by Joe Feo is, even before failures, I believe answer lies in putting the controls in where the controls are needed, so inspection. However, not to develop reliance on such non-value-added task. By measuring and monitoring, I believe improvement will be made and the controls lifted. Do you agree that a simple whiteboard representation is a very good visual aid to monitor this progress? And I'm triggered, I'm asking this question because you just mentioned some visual aids before.
Yeah, I think what he means by a whiteboard is some gemba board out there. The best visual aid is seeing a process capability chart of some form that tell me how that process is performing in a relative close period of time to when I'm standing there. For instance, I see boards with control charts of last year's performance. I see control charts of with no control limits on it. The reality is, how do I know? How does the operator know? How does the manager know of a given production line or a given where you are, how we are doing to our standard? And is that standard good enough for the customer? That information is so far detached from that whiteboard. And I'll give you a good example. We were working within an organization that had tremendous, great customer value. Product is great. To that company who has very high quality standards, the defect rate wasn't good enough. And meaning, their escape rate was almost zero, almost perfect. Nothing ever escaped to the customer. But internally, and they don't inspect, it's all end-of-line tests, they had too high a defect rate. And we noticed that they would always meet their defect targets over a 12-month period, right? So if I set it for 10,000 parts per million, and by the end of the year, I was at 5. And I said, well, why are they going like this? Why not go like this? And so there was something flawed in there. So sometimes you have to point out what's different. And what they found, you know, what we found was the root cause analysis thinking always went to the operator. The operator wasn't trained. The operator made a mistake. And so their visual boards, okay, their visual boards, they had visual boards in front of them, the operator is responsible to, had errors in them. So now you've got the operator being blamed for following the visual board with errors in it. Mm-hmm. One thing for sure, if that board is not a controlled document, it doesn't get reviewed. Mm-hmm. It doesn't get reviewed, it could create failure. And that's, so I always tell people that an audit is not about the big picture, it's in the detail. And a process capability study, you find out things in the detail. If you don't do it, you don't find out the detail. Just like leaders, operators are inherently good. Producers are apparently good. You give them bad tools, bad techniques. And this is what I see eroding over the, you know, because we have a document control and work instructions, or we have standard work, but it's not being reviewed frequently to know that things are changing. Engineering is changing things, but those things aren't changing. So whatever you have, whiteboard is good. It's got to stay up to date. It's got to be current. It's got to be useful to what you're trying to do.
Yeah. So culture, let's shift the conversation a little bit towards culture, because we got some questions in around that. So Marcia's saying that, and this is something that I can definitely recognize, and possibly you do too, Joe. I'd be curious to hear you, but that her experience is that quality isn't really regarded as an equal within the department. So there's a there's this effect of, you know, we're raising the flag at times, but, you know, management doesn't want to hear what management doesn't want to hear, you know, the messenger getting shot. I've heard this before. I hear it a lot, that quality departments feel like they're sort of, the redheaded stepchild off in the corner, the department that's there to prevent bad quality from going out the door, but they're not really getting a seat at the table, you know, so it's taxation without representation. What are your thoughts on that?
The same thoughts I've had for 30 years, because the question keeps coming up. There's so many different levels in organizations, or different types of organizations. There's small, there's mid, there's large, there's excessive, there's too big to fail. So it's very hard to answer that question specifically, but I'll zero in on the capability of the messenger to deliver the message to leaders in regardless of where they are. Mm-hmm. So the first step is, how capable is the messenger able to explain to the leadership what is wrong and what we should do about it? We use the expression that, you know, we talk, the shop floor talks in defects, leadership talks in return on investment. So there's a gap there. So you have to talk in the language of management, which is somehow the language of money that they have to get. But there are gatekeepers along the way that have to be, you know, you don't just get to jump to the top. I've never seen a CEO or a COO, high level executive, turn away from a discussion about improving product, reducing costs or improving profitability.
Right.
They'll listen. But the people in between, I think, and that's what she's commenting on there, you know, they're like obstacles. And so you have to understand how each one is going to help you move up the chain. The problem here is that someone's got to be receptive at the top to your message. And so either you got to have a new messenger or a new message, or hope it gets worse. I saw an organization, and I see many of them like that, where the emphasis to ship the product with a known defect that will not show up for 5 or 6 years because it will rust out, went all the way to the president, and the president accepted it. It's like, okay, we got to ship it. We're going to ship it. So there's nothing you can do in that organization until a change of leadership. Honestly, nothing's going to change because it was right up the top. Others would not go one level without bringing it to the top and say, we got to do something about this.
Right.
The one, I think, the message and the messenger. And the other one is, you know, there is the acceptance or finding a leader within the leadership that is willing to carry that message for you. Why doesn't quality sit on the, you know, leadership team or the board team? Mm-hmm. It's mostly because the belief is that quality is everyone's responsibility. Mm-hmm. And so if I have my head of operations or if I had a head of supply chain, they get it. And I think a lot of people, particularly if you look at LinkedIn, think that you should never have a quality department. The reality is there are tasks that have to be done that are independent of those people. Mm-hmm. And that independence should be representative somehow. And I'm seeing it in pharmaceutical companies where I coach some chief quality officers. They are on the leadership team. You'll see that at Boeing, they promoted a senior VP of quality. Sometimes it just takes a long time to get that acceptance that that function is critical. For instance, there's so many different people that could be on a leadership team today. Diversity, inclusion, you know, DIE, number one. We want people who can help us create happy employees. We want quality. There's so many things they want. The question is, start with the customer. What do they want? Honestly, the customers don't care much about anything if my product or service works. So that representation has to be there. And I'm all for putting people on there as long as they're capable. But I believe the answer to her question is that they don't know what they don't know. and they believe that their surrogates are in there talking about quality, but they're talking about quality not as a quality management function, but in the customer perception of quality, which is not always the same.
Great. Warsame had a question about, you know, he works for a small organization. They're not digitized, so there's no software QMS. They're starting from scratch, it seems. So this is a broad question, but what would you recommend? It sounds like there's a bit of a greenfield situation. That's how I'm interpreting his question. What would you recommend a company that is defining their quality organization? What would they need to do to prevent these issues from happening that you talk about in your, you know, in your analysis?
Well, in 2023, we did a series of webinars on the digital quality management system and quality 4.0. Mm-hmm. And for the last 5 or 6 years, I've been squawking about what is quality 4.0 as it relates to quality. And the simple answer is, if you don't start with some digital quality management system, you're wasting your time because everything else is paper. So number one, and the reason we say that now, because they're very affordable. 10 years ago, they were not affordable. So if you're a small company, there are quality management systems that you can begin with that make it affordable. And I won't brag, but Ali's QI is one of them. And the reason is they're affordable today because they modularize things. You break them up into small parts. So if you're a small company looking to manage quality, start there. You know, start with a module and work from there. And, you know, one of the most important modules you can start with are, what are the elements of our system that enable us to produce high quality product and meet our targets. And another one would be, you know, in the absence of we get failure, how can we do root cause analysis? And so the digital system from the beginning will give you history over time, right? So you'll be able to start there. If you skip that and just start with manual, you've wasted a lot of time because the question is, why would you do that? So documentation, you know, you're creating manual documents, you might as well have a quality management system to manage the documents. My big issue is, don't pick a document management system, quality management system. There are some companies out there that are selling quality management systems, but they're really just document management systems. You want to have a system that allows you to do, input of data, analysis of data, and capture, you know, to be able to perform in closest to real time, how we're doing. And that is a big difference between, you know, there's a big difference between documentation management quality and data management of quality. And so, and with new technologies, it's getting to be both combined. And my recommendation is find one that's got both combined. And also there seems to be we do quality management assessments, staff assessments, and professional. We have a professional leadership program, which goes beyond what Chartered Quality Institute or American Society for Quality have, because they stop at, you know, certified quality manager. What do you do beyond that? And a lot of times you can't even find a book that says, how do I develop a quality management system? Just, you know, step. Our quality management handbook by Duran Institute, who's in its 70th year, has a whole chapter on a quality management system. But yet, most of it is pick and choose, because every organization has to pick and choose what it needs to manage for quality. There's so many different, you know, so there's no one prescription. And that's why the ISO systems are flawed, because they try to give you a prescription. So these quality professionals that are coming up need to be digitally inclined now. They need to understand that their job and everybody else's job is going to come extinct if they don't accept the digitalization of their quality management system. And, you know, just simply, you know, doing a process capability study, you know, you're going to take 10,000 data points or 1,000 data points or a million data points. You got to do something with it. And, you know, simply put, how capable is your process? You're not going to do that with an Excel spreadsheet anymore. You're not going to do that with Minitab. You're going to do that with something more integrated. The other thing, too, is the second point we made was, if you pick a quality manager, just to make sure that it's able to integrate with your ERP system. Even a small company has some form of a management, digital management system, whether it's, you know, in place, even QuickBooks. So that second issue we said is make sure your quality management system is able to integrate, because that has other data that leadership looks at. So if you're pulling data in from the product in terms of failures, acceptance, and they have units produced and quality, you know, you can use that information. So second one, it's got to be able to fit. And the third one is it's got to be able to expand. As a small business gets bigger, it's got to expand. And my unfortunate experience is that even large companies are not using their quality digital quality management system to their most definite advantage. They don't utilize a lot of the tools, the modules. So my experience is, go module by module, get good at it, and keep expanding it. Don't try to go for the whole ball of wax in the beginning and say, wow, we got all these pieces.
So, Joe, let's put ourselves in the hypothetical situation that you get a call from leadership from Ford Motor Company, or and they want you to consult with them. You know, they you know, their stock price dropped 11%. They took a big hit. They realized they have a problem. They want a fresh view on, you know, how to get out of this situation. Maybe just talk us through how you would approach that. I want to sort of move towards solutions. What give people that are listening to us some more ideas on, if they recognize this problem, what can they do? How can they approach this within their own organization?
If you were a patient going into a doctor's office, and the doctor, who's a physician, internal medicine, realized you had a severe illness, he or she would immediately recommend you to a specialist. And that specialist is known in their field as being good at something, and therefore you go to that specialist. That specialist, in a very short time, can kind of nail down what you need to do next. Ford is a big company, Boeing's a big company, and we have had those phone calls from others, not them, I wish they would. But the first thing I would say is that, you know, and Dr. Duran would do this in a day. A specialist should be able to figure out in a day what's going on and where can they start. And I would go, you know, in a few questions asked of leadership, a few questions asked of mid-level leadership, a few questions asked on the floor, give them a walk, look at some data. You can, and basically what I would be looking at is, I already know your crisis. What are the methods you're doing over here? And it shouldn't take long, but I also would recommend an all-star team. I would recommend that they pull together an all-star team. And I'll give you an example. This scenario happened in the 1980s and the early 90s. We did get calls from Ford in the beginning. And I use this example, and I don't know why Ford's having the trouble they're having now with defects, but in 1980, Ford recalled more cars than it sold. And that's a pretty phenomenal measure. So if you sold a million cars, you recalled a million cars. And that's how the level of quality was. By I don't know, around late 1980s, early 90s, Ford had reclaimed the best performing car in America, the Taurus. It was the Taurus and the Honda were going back and forth constantly with, you know, but Honda had beat it, and then they were going back and forth. But what transpired between 1980 in 1990 was what they did differently. So what I would be focusing on is, what are you doing different than you were 5 years ago, 10 years ago? And I'll guarantee it's some of the things we're talking about.
Yeah.
I don't know a lot about the Ford culture. It's been one of the best performing companies of all times, but they have their problems. And regardless of who it is, I think in one day you'd be able to figure out what they should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
What I didn't like was what, I don't know, we don't know what Boeing was doing on the inside, but to the outside, they gave this impression we're having this one day shut down the factory for quality day. That's just useless.
Right.
That's like saying, I blame all of you for the problem. Right. And it's a solution. It's trying to put the medicine before the diagnosis. So the message is, you know, go in there and do a diagnosis, do a, you know, quantitative review, talk to the right people, get the right information, and then create an all-star team to go from there. And I say an all-star team because, you know, it sounds like Boeing had an issue with when they farmed out this big unit to Spirit Airways or whatever, and now they've bought it back. If you look at the history of how work has been done and manufacturing done over the last 40 years, there was a push in the 80s to break up companies to be more focused on what they're good at. And so some companies are really good at designing things, so they got rid of manufacturing. Other companies are really good at manufacturing things, so they farmed out design. And when you farm them out, you believe they are no longer part of your focus of quality interest. And I always, you know, tell people that, hey, I had a company that was completely integrated. And in the 80s and 90s, we broke it apart. And now they're not part of my culture. We have a very good quality culture, but it's up to them to figure out theirs. And we don't have enough supplier quality interface to know if it's good or bad. And so over time, it just got weaker and weaker and weaker. Boeing said, hey, we need to pull them back in. Well, that's a good strategy, pull them back in. But there's so many companies who did it, you know. And so what you need to do is strengthen the supplier partner, the supplier quality side. And you can't do that if you have five supplier quality people and 10,000 suppliers. You know, you've got to put the resources there. So more than likely, you need an all-star team to say, hey, you know, we need people, experts in supply chain. You know, I'm an expert at quality management, operational excellence, but I don't know all the nuances of all those other things. I'd bring in guys that I'm, you know, people that I've known, people that are known today. And here's the failure. More than likely, they're going to call McKinsey, PwC, and Deloitte. And it would be like that physician giving you to another internal medicine physician. They have different goals, different experiences. And more than likely, they won't be calling us.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
I'd like them to.
Two of your specific recommendations in your paper were to, one was obviously to shift from qualitative to more quantitative auditing. And then the other was to maybe give leadership some more tools to ask the right questions, right, to kind of control, surface this type of problem earlier proactively. Are those sound like relatively straightforward, you know, recommendations and improvements? Are they as simple as they sound, or do some of these run deep and are more sort of longer term transformational things? Can you shed a little bit of light on how you would actually do this?
Well, you know, quality leadership is a choice, meaning in quality leadership in our term meant, you know, we want to be the lead in quality, like Toyota is the lead in quality in automotive. So Boeing wants to be the lead. You know, they got to be better than their competitors in all aspects of that. So one, it's a choice. And if they choose to make that choice, then the implementation of what leadership should do is easy. Right. If they don't want to make that choice, it's hard. Mm-hmm. But I think there are some systemic things that could be made. So some of the recommendations I made were, one, make visible your audit results to everyone, including third party financial. Hell, if I were wanting to invest in Ford, I'd want to know if there was something under the hood that I don't know about. So show me. So I'd want to know the warranties. I want to see what the, not just the cost of warranty, but what are you doing about reducing the warranties? Not until after my stock drives. So if there's a desire to be truly quality leader, then make visible the metrics that can show us how we're doing to yourselves, to the organization, and to your partners outside of you. There's a provision in all the ISO requirements of management representative. And that is a major flaw. A management representative should be the management that is at the top of the organization that signs off on something. I was working with a Dutch submarine manufacturer. And in order for the submarine to be approved, to be shipped to the customer, which is the military, the president had to go down on the dive, first dive. And let me tell you, that president wasn't going to go down on the first dive on a submarine unless he knows he'd come back up. So the management representative, the word representative is a mistake. So one thing that can happen easily is that leadership identifies someone on the leadership team that is truly going to be the management representative of the quality management system. And that linkage is very important because right now it's down low levels. And what it says is management is periodically going to review the quality management system. Management is going to do their gumbo walks. Management is going to understand the results. Well, they're so far apart from that, they have no idea. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is a big change that should be made, that, and not management representative, but the leadership representative. And I think it's important. And also internal audits, they can easily fix. Internal audits could be made to be quantitative very quickly. I wish there was a better way to say those things. I get it mixed up. Quantitative, meaning these are the metrics that are important to us. Show me what you're doing to drive those metrics. And if you don't have good product quality, process control quality, you're probably never going to get there. You can have the greatest lean implementation, you're not going to get there because there are things missing in that. Also, here's one thing that is really important that leadership has to come to grips with. Stop talking about lean and Six Sigma and quality until you define what your organization means by it. And this is a real problem I have, is that a company wants to be a lean organization, and 20 years ago that had a different meaning than it does today. And so what does it mean? And what are we doing? The things we're doing.
Right.
So you see a lot of people say, we know Boeing spent a lot of time on lean. Well, really, did they? What are they doing? So get away from the words and really understand what you're doing.
Right.
See, the thing about ISO 9000, it was a defined system. You do these things. You kind of know what it is, right? But lean is not a defined system. OpEx is not a defined system. You know, there's vagueness. There's some guidelines, but there's no real strictness. So what are you doing? What company did you hire to do it with? Was it reputable? Was it experienced? You know, are you trying to be Toyota or are you trying to be something else? So it's very important that they define that. So
sort of link it to clear goals. And
well, it's understanding what you mean by those words.
Mm.
So it's easy when Ford says we have too many high warranties. Warranties is failure. The replacement of, you know, warranties are failure. Some of those are design. Some of those are manufacture. Some of those are probably operator. You know, I beat the heck out of my car, so, you know, probably have a lot of brake issues, or I forget to put oil in them, you know. So it's easy. That's their definition of quality, is reduction of warranties or less warranties. So if you don't have clarity of what those words mean, quality is not a good word. Lean's not a good word. Excellence is not a good word. You got to have further definition. So I think they really need to understand what they mean by those things at the leadership level so that they can talk about it better.
Thank you. All right, Joe, we have almost talked for an hour, and it's been fascinating. Lots and lots of gold nuggets here and insights. I want to give the attendees a few more opportunities to ask some questions, and then we'll work towards a wrap up. So call out to the people on the, you know, that are listening. If you have any other questions for Joe, please share them through the chat, and we'll make sure that they get answered. Thank you, Gary. Appreciate that.
There was one question there. I don't know. So Stephen mentioned quality culture. There's a lot of, you know, books written on culture, and we have a, everybody wants to, you know, I want a culture of excellence. I want a culture of continuous improvement. I want a culture of X. I did a paper a few months ago about everybody wants a different kind of culture when in fact they all want the same culture. They want a high performing culture, right? They want to be good to customers, good to the employees, good to the shareholders. You know, that's kind of the nature of a good company. But you don't start there, you get there. Mm-hmm. And this is something you have to understand, is that cultures are formed based on habits and beliefs. And this was one of Dr. Duran's things that sunk into my head early on, because I heard from him early on, was if you want to change the culture, you've got to change their habits. And then their beliefs will change, then the culture will change. So he then said, if you want to be a culture of quality and continuous improvement, then you got to create the habit of improvement. And that's what led to project by project improvement. It's very logical. Hmm. Project by project creates new habits that we're not going to accept poor quality. We're not going to accept inefficiency. We're not going to accept this. And we get good at it. And all of a sudden, those habits start to demonstrate a belief that management cares about us, about the customer. And I will tell you, a company you never hear about is Texas Instruments. I hear from people at Texas Instruments today that are retiring, and new employees are still getting indoctrinated into the Texas Instruments way. It was called the Blue Book of how to think about those things. It's the same thing Duran said. It's the same thing I say, because I'm a representative of that thinking, is that you don't just go to culture. You've got to create habits and beliefs. How do you create habits and beliefs? Well, what beliefs do you want? So I want a belief that quality is important. Then aim at product quality, customer quality. If DEI is important and you want a culture of inclusivity, then identify the things that are preventing you from being there. Hiring practices, reward and recognition practices, performance, all those kind of things. So habits and beliefs change culture. I found no other way. And what's amazing is you can create some habits very fast with the right process and process controls in place. I see so many people wanting, you know, can you give us green belt training? I want green belt training so we could change our culture. And there's nothing. There's just chain of green belts, and they're, you know, they go into the organization, they can't do anything. That's not the answer. There's no habits in there about doing improvement. No.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Joe, I want to thank you for making the time to come speak with us. You have a lot of experience and very clear thoughts and a great way of articulating them. So it's been fascinating. I've learned a lot. And hopefully we can do this again. I think, you know, in this conversation, we probably laid the groundwork for 3 or 4 more topics that we could easily talk about. So thank you for, making the time and being with us.
And thank you. And one last thing, if you folks out there don't know about Alex QI, I suggest you take a look at it. It's actually pretty good company, pretty good product.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks for that endorsement. I have one more comment or a few more comments for the attendees. Marcia, you had a couple of questions around sort of getting a seat at the table from the quality department. I'm going to send you some information that I think you might find useful on that topic. Everyone, just a reminder, we'll send you a recording. If you have any follow-up questions for Joe or for myself, you know, please send them to us. I'll make sure that Joe gets them, and you know, we'll get some follow-up there for you. Thanks, Joe. All right, everyone, thanks again. Talk to you soon. All right, bye-bye.